Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Monday, March the 4th, 2024. And today I have a very interesting guest whose name you might not know, but whose company I suggest if you're an American abroad, you have heard of, and that is Greenback Tax Services. Joining me today is David McKeegan, the founder and the brains and energy behind the growth of Greenback Tax over the years. And I'm certainly looking forward to chatting with him, not so much about U.S. taxes, about the impact that U.S. taxes has on a group near and dear to our hearts, that is Americans abroad. So welcome, David. Thanks so much for joining me. And how are you today?
Yeah, very good. Thank you. I would be remiss if I claimed that I was the brains behind Greenback. I think my wife deserves a credit for that one. I can just say I'm the pretty face.
Well, you had the brains to marry her, didn't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. So we'll give you that at least. Okay. That's great. Well, you know, I mean, I don't think that too many people, you know, growing up in the United States would wake up one day and say, my God, I'm going to start a tax prep service for Americans abroad. So I'm guessing that there was some sort of chain of events that got you there. And maybe we can begin with, how is it that you found yourself outside the United States anyway?
Sure. So my wife and I decided we wanted to pursue our MBAs. And, you know, we looked at some schools in the U.S. and we started thinking about schools outside the U.S. as well. And we ended up choosing a school in Barcelona, Spain called IESE. And so back in 2002, we moved to Spain and started our MBA program in Barcelona. And that was, geez, I guess 22 years ago. And that was when we left the United States.
And I gather that that turned out to be a permanent move from the United States.
Yeah, you know, we thought it was a 2-year thing, right? And that was kind of our joke years later is, you know, we left the U.S. for 2 years, 10 years ago. But, you know, once we finished the MBA program, then we moved to London and we got jobs in finance in London. And, you know, things have just progressed from there.
Okay, that's interesting. Now, so you're in London. So you're, you know, you go through the MBA thing and, you know, you're students with presumably relatively low income and, you know, low tax filing needs, for, I guess, presumably?
Yeah, you know, when we were students, there was no tax filing need because we weren't making any money. So that was relatively easy. It got a bit more complicated when we moved to London because then we were paying Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs, you know, 20, 40% of our salary each year, and having to file the U.S. side also just to make sure we were compliant with everything. And, you know, learned a couple lessons the hard way at that time. I wasn't in the tax industry at that point in time, but learned a couple lessons the hard way at that time around PFIX and, you know, the foreign earned income exclusion versus the foreign tax credit and all these different things.
Not exactly pleasant topics, are they?
No, they certainly were not. And, you know, a couple of years after we were living in London, this is right around the time of the financial crisis, my wife and I were trying to come up with business ideas because we thought, you know, our banking jobs aren't going to do too well for the next couple of years, given everything that's going on in the finance industry. So let's try and come up with an idea. We can, you know, start a company and do something different for a couple of years. And, you know, the expat tax business kept rising to the top of our list because we knew firsthand what a pain it was. Because we had made a couple of mistakes ourselves, we already had a good idea where the issues were and where we could help people out. And we thought, hey, this is something where we can put something together and really make a difference, really help people out and try and stop them from making the same mistakes that we had already made.
Well, that's interesting. So I guess like all, you know, good business ideas, and I think good businesses, period, you know, they have to you know, need some definite. I mean, you know, the only way you can make money in life, as far as I can see, is help other people prosper, whether that's financial or otherwise. So now you say, so it kept rising to the top. So whether you looked at it upside down, sideways, diagonally, it was like this U.S. tax thing was always there as a problem.
Well, we knew a lot of Americans in London, and we knew that for all of them, this was an issue. We suspected that there were people in, you know, all these other cities around the world that were having the same issues. And for us, a big thing that we wanted was to be able to stay international. We didn't want to, you know, move back to New York City and get jobs in New York City as opposed to jobs in London. And we thought, well, you know, if we've got a business that we can run on the internet because all of our clients are spread all around the world, then that makes a big difference lifestyle-wise for what we can do. And so, you know, this is back in 2009. We were able to go 100% remote at that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, it would seem to me that unless you're content with just running a very local business, but a lot of people do in the tax prep area, that you're presumptively online all the time, aren't you?
Yeah, you know, I think it's different now than it was then. Yeah, I think even today, I think a lot of tax preparers are very, very local. You know, you deal with the people in your town or within a 20-mile, 25-mile radius from where you are, because, you know, doing taxes can be very personal for people. Americans in particular don't enjoy sharing their financial standing with other people. You know, there's every now and then you see statistics out there about how people are unwilling to tell, you know, long-term life partners or even spouses how much money they make. You know, they don't want to share their bank records with, you know, their spouse or anybody. And yet, you know, every year they walk into an accountant's office or, you know, I guess now upload all this stuff to the accountant's portal with all their information about how they're doing and financially across all the different areas of their life.
Yeah. I mean, so you're in London and you haven't yet started this business. You're paying somebody to help you with this? You're paying a expat tax preparer?
Yeah, we were using the same local accountant that we had been using when we were living in New York. And so that kind of started a lot of the problems we had, whereas he wasn't an expert in the international side of things.
Yeah.
Of course. Things started going haywire pretty quickly.
Yeah, I can well imagine that. I think that, yeah, people inside the United States who are sort of tax prep people generally have no idea.
Yeah.
you know, the circumstances that impact Americans abroad. All right. So you had some missteps, some misfilings, maybe some small penalties. I'm not asking. I'm just thinking out loud. And you thought, oh, my God. There's got to be a business that can be built around this problem.
Yeah, exactly. And that was basically the thinking, is this is a big problem, and it's not just a problem for us. This is a problem probably for all Americans living overseas.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. So, again, I mean, I've been aware of your company or your former company. We'll get to that in a minute. I mean, for really a lot of years. But, I mean, I'm not a tax preparer. But my impression has been that you sort of, you know, you didn't so much try to learn all this yourself as you, you know, went out and got competent CPAs or tax preparers in various parts of the world. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. So what we were doing is we were bringing on CPAs or IRS enrolled agents who were working directly with the clients, doing the tax work for the clients. And so we had a vetting process to make sure that they knew what they were doing, that they, you know, had the appropriate skill level and everything like that in order to work with clients. And yeah, I forget exactly what it was, but I think 90% or 95% of accountants that applied with us didn't make it past the screening process. So yeah, we're pretty diligent about making sure that the people that work with us knew what they were doing.
Yeah. Well, that's that. Yeah, I mean, that's a necessity. What kind of vetting process did you use? I mean, did you give them an exam? Did you give them a sample? Here, can you prepare this tax return? What? How do you vet somebody for that type of stuff?
We had an exam that people would take. We gave them sample tax returns to prepare. Yeah, just a couple of different steps and interviews to make sure that, you know, they could communicate well with clients and, you know, were clear in their written and verbal communications, things like that.
So they weren't really working for you. These would be independent tax preparers who would work with you, but also work with other people, basically. Is that?
Yeah. In the beginning, when we were very small, it was the way it worked out was that people would have like their own side practice and then they would do some work for us. As the business grew over the years, a lot of people started working solely for us because it was, you know, more than enough work for these accountants and they could make a good living doing it. And again, you know, people like working remote. You know, this is all pre-COVID, so not a lot of people had the option at that point. And so people really enjoyed that opportunity as well.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, I mean, just sort of, so you're in London when you're sort of building this? Is that where you were living?
So it sort of coincided with the birth of our first child. So when our son was born, we stayed in London for a couple of weeks to make sure he got all his, you know, vaccines and everything in the beginning. And then we went to South America and we lived in Brazil and Uruguay for about 9 months as we were getting the business off the ground.
Why there?
You know, we had spent some time traveling around Argentina and Brazil when we were in business school. And we had heard that Uruguay was a pretty fantastic expat destination. And so we just wanted to go down and try it on, see if it suited us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you're building the sort of the origins of it would have been at that time when you're in South America.
Okay.
So, I mean, gradually you began to identify, I gather, the countries where, you know, there were huge masses of American citizens with this type of problem. And so what, you targeted those countries primarily, or were you just sort of marketing the world?
It was more of like a pull marketing strategy. So we were just trying to put out good information, like to clarify what the issues people were having were and explain to people how to avoid them or how to fix it if they found themselves with one of these issues. And, you know, because my wife and I aren't accountants by training, we sort of always viewed things from the customer perspective as opposed to from the IRS or, you know, the CPA perspective. And so we were able to communicate, I think, in a way that people really understood much better than a lot of the companies that were doing it at the time.
In other words, the other companies were talking about tax and you were talking about people.
Yeah, you know, the other people were talking about IRS regulation X, Y, and Z. And we were saying, hey, if you're living in XYZ city and you open a bank account, you have to remember to report it. You know, imagine trying to explain something to a friend or a neighbor or like your parents or something like that in a way that like they just understand it as opposed to with all the jargon, all the, you know, this form, that form, you know, this procedure, all that kind of word.
So you're basically offering a public service generally, and some of those people became your customers, clients?
Yeah, basically. Like, you know, we're just trying to put out good information so people knew what they had to do. And then once it's out there, people go looking for it and they would find it and they would find us as a result.
Okay. So that's quite interesting. And so this was, I'm not so sure. I mean, I know a lot of sort of expat tax prep services, but I don't know that I've seen many that are sort of as internationalized as yours became.
Yeah. Again, I think a lot of tax firms tend to be very local. And there's markets out there where you can survive that way. Like if you're an American doing taxes in London, there's a good number of Americans living in London that need that service.
Yeah, for sure.
you know, the advantage we had is we could work with those people in London, but we could also help out the guy that lives in South Africa and the guy that lives in, you know, Brazil or wherever else. You know, we had the world as our market, if you will.
But what percentage of that market would have been, or your client base would have been, you know, from sort of larger like London, Paris, Brussels, to Tokyo? Do you have any clients in Canada?
We did have a decent number of clients in Canada. You know, Canada, Mexico, you get a lot of accountants retiring to those places. And so they pick up a lot of that local business. Whereas places like London, Tokyo, yeah, some of these bigger cities around the world, you know, we did get a pretty good chunk of our clientele from places like that.
Interesting. Okay. So you're kind of growing this thing, and this is starting, what, 2009, 2010? Would that be the sort of launch year or years?
Yep.
So I'm imagining that you had very decent growth. And then my next question is, were you impacted significantly by the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act?
We weren't impacted significantly. We had a handful of accountants retire at that point because it was such a big change to the tax code that they were like, I'm not going to learn a whole new tax code at my age. I'm just going to call it quits and
get out of it.
So we were impacted in that way, but you know, we weren't impacted in like negatively in other ways, if you know what I mean.
So your company sort of independently of your tax preparers was able to sort of seamlessly absorb GILTI and, you know, all that type of stuff.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, if I were to say that year, things became even more complex for Americans abroad, would you say that was a true statement?
I think it definitely had the possibility to be more complex for people. You know, for somebody with a fairly simple situation, they probably weren't that impacted. But the more complex your tax situation is or was, the more likely you were to be impacted by it.
Mm-hmm. And your client base, I'm just kind of guessing, would it be fairly simple, everyday people?
Yeah, we really spread the gamut. We had clients all across the board. We had, you know, people that were entrepreneurs. We had people that owned businesses overseas. We had people that were sort of in that digital nomad kind of crowd, like running a business in the U.S. but living overseas.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we had just plain vanilla employees working at libraries around the world, you know, things like that as well. So it really spread the gamut of clients all over.
So your business then was more finding the appropriate tax preparer for the job rather than saying, well, you know, we do this or we do that.
Yeah, it was making sure that the accountant that we teamed people up with was able to help that person in their specific situation.
So you would have a general awareness of this is somebody who can manage CFCs versus this is somebody who doesn't do much of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And you would have a sense of, you know, what a digital nomad is looking for, something different from a long-term.
Yeah,
it's quite interesting. So, you know, in this moment, I think it might be interesting to get your perception on, you know, the U.S. tax system, its impact on Americans abroad. I mean, what do you think of it? Where do you think it's going? What do you think of the incentives to renounce U.S. citizenship, all that kind of stuff?
Well, you know, the way I always like to describe it is there's only three countries in the world that tax their citizens regardless of where they live: Eritrea, North Korea, and the United States. So, you know, that's the company we have, right? So that kind of says a lot about that taxation model.
Well, but I mean, somebody from U.S. Treasury might say that, you know, citizenship taxation is one of the redeeming features of Eritrea and North.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know that much about the Eritrean tax laws. So I couldn't say one way or the other. But yeah, I think I sort of understand that it's a carryover from years and years past that I think for a long time sort of went unnoticed or, yeah, unenforced, largely unenforced by the U.S. government. Yeah, I think given the number of Americans overseas and the way the voting process works, we, in a lot of ways, we are being taxed without fair representation because all of our votes get funneled back through whatever state we were last registered to vote in. And so instead of being able to vote as a block where we'd actually be able to get some things done, you know, we're treated as individual, you know, citizens of states that, you know, maybe we haven't lived in 20 years. So, you know, I think that combined with the fact that they keep making things more complicated seems to be, you know, seems to make life difficult for Americans overseas.
It does. I think it definitely does. Well, I mean, what do you think about the whole renunciation issues?
It's
a growing number who just can't take it anymore.
Yeah. And, you know, for me, I've looked at that. It's not really an option for me because I have a lot of family that's still in the U.S. And so I wouldn't want to put myself in a situation where, you know, if I had a parent or a sibling that was sick, I wasn't able to get back and spend time with them. So personally, I don't view it as an option. I think, you know, for a lot of people that would fall into the accidental American basket, it's, you know, probably a very good option because, especially if they do it younger, because they can kind of get out of that, the cycle of, you know, being stuck under the U.S. tax regime. But, you know, it largely depends on what you want to do and where you want to be. Obviously, the U.S. is a huge economy. Having access to be able to live and work in that economy is pretty fantastic in a lot of ways. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword, I would say.
Well, anyway, I mean, it seems to me, though, that it is U.S. citizenship is kind of a depreciating asset, you know, from the point of view of access to the economy. I mean, I do agree that it has it's very valuable for younger people charting out their careers. You know, for people retiring, I don't know. You know, I mean, certainly that aspect of it doesn't have the same value.
Yeah. You know, I don't think this will ever happen, but I've always thought it would be a great idea to make it possible to sell your citizenship, right? You know, you've got millions of people trying to cross the border into the U.S. every year, and you've got, you know, thousands of people trying to get out of the U.S. every year. Why not just be a proper capitalist country and make a market?
Well, that's a very interesting idea, actually. I mean, I've also, you know, sort of in a similar vein, I've often considered whether it might be wise for some of these countries with a lot of dual citizens living in them, like Canada or the UK, to simply offer to buy those citizens back from the United States. You know, the sense that here, you know, because, I mean, U.S. citizenship taxation to some degree is base erosion of the economies where they live, right? You know, sell a house, pay a huge tax on capital gain that the government of that country wants to keep that money in the country, you know, for housing, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, this is a problem, it seems to me, on a lot of different levels. But, you know, I think that the idea, I mean, people are buying citizenships already, as you know. Yeah. You know, and the idea of a U.S. citizen being able to sell their citizenship to somebody else, sort of a transferable thing, I think is interesting. You know, and for other countries, simply buy their citizens back. You know, I mean, I think these are options that perhaps might be worth considering. I mean, citizenship is being monetized in the world as it stands right now. I mean, you can buy a citizenship here, there, and everywhere. So,
yeah,
you know, I don't know. I mean, I certainly a lot of people regard this stuff as off the wall, but I'm not so sure that it is at all.
Yeah, I can see a case for why individuals would want to do it. I can't really see a case where a country would want to buy the citizens if they're already living there, because you probably already have first crack at their taxable income and everything like that.
Well, because the U.S. taxes things the other country doesn't, you know, like say, you know, gain on a principal residence, but also because, you know, the overlay of U.S. tax laws for Americans abroad makes it much harder for those people to participate in local financial retirement planning programs, you know, because, then you know, and this is, and what this does is that it, you know, has potential, I think, to create sort of an underclass of people who have much more difficulty taking responsibility for financial planning.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't, it's a complicated problem, but I do think there's a dimension to this where one might look at the effect that it has on the country where Americans are actually living. I mean, it can't be having a good effect, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, another thing, you know, looking down the road, you look at, you know, the Biden Green Book and this sort of stuff, it seems pretty clear that the U.S. is trying to move in the direction of, you know, deemed dispositions, deemed gains, deemed sales. And what that's going to do is it's going to create a taxable event prior to the taxable event in the country where they live, right? You know, we're just setting this thing up for double taxation. So, you know, as much of a problem as this is for the individuals, I can see major problems, you know, for the countries where they live down the road if the U.S. transitions into a tax system that is, you know, fundamentally incompatible of the tax system, the country where they live.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure. I guess we'd have to see how it all plays out in a lot of ways to really understand what the implications are and what that would mean to other countries. You know, like take the UK as an example. Like, yeah, at what point would they say, you know what, it's easier if we just rewrite the tax treaty and say, all right, all these people are deemed as UK citizens if they're resident here or something like that. But, you know, the U.S. is so focused on tax cheats that they don't really realize that a lot of the time when you're living overseas, you might be paying a higher tax rate overseas than you would be paying taxes in the U.S. You know, when I was living in London, I was paying much higher taxes than I would have been paying had I been paying taxes in the U.S. So, but yeah, everybody was like, well, if you have money overseas, you must be a tax cheat. It's like, no, like, paying taxes where I'm living and earning money. And then, yeah, I have this additional filing requirement to show the U.S. government that I'm not a tax cheat. It's almost like you're deemed guilty before you have a option to say anything else.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right on that. I don't know why the U.S. culturally seems incapable of realizing that. It's as though the definition of a tax cheat is not that you don't pay taxes, it's that you don't pay them to the United States, right? I mean, who cares, you know, if you already pay 60% tax in the UK?
Yeah.
The only question is, are you paying us?
Right.
You know, sort of thing. And yeah, I mean, that's definitely a big problem.
And this thing this week, I don't know if you saw this come out last week, where the IRS is now going to go after people who make over $400,000 a year and haven't filed their tax returns. It's like, wait, what? It's like you've got a list of people going back to 2017 who make $400,000 a year and haven't filed a tax return. And these people aren't getting letters every year. These people aren't getting a knock on their door where, you know, the poor person that's living overseas that, you know, forgets to report that they own a shop and they get a $25,000 automatic penalty for, you know, failing to report that they own a business overseas, or, you know, they have FBAR penalties and all this kind of stuff. It's like, yeah, what are we focusing on here? Like, obviously, the guy making $400,000 a year living in the U.S., not even bothering to file a tax return, should be where they're focused. But,
well, I think it's pretty clear that that somebody making $400,000 plus per year in the U.S. who doesn't file a tax return, I think it's pretty clear they must owe U.S. tax, right?
Well, yeah, you would have to. I can't imagine how you would have that level of income and not owe tax on.
Well, I don't either. But, you know, you could easily have somebody making $400,000 a year in London, living in London, who would not owe U.S. tax, you know, just because of the foreign tax credit rules and that.
Well, yeah, if you're making the equivalent of $400K in the U.K., yeah, I believe you'd be in the 40 percentile bracket in the U.K. I haven't followed U.K. tax rules in quite a while, but last time I looked, their top rate was about 40%. So you'd be paying more tax in the U.K. than you'd be paying in the U.S. So you'd be using the foreign tax credit. You'd offset things that way. But if you're living in the U.S. and you're making that kind of money, I don't know that there is any way to not pay any tax on that money. And at least the article I read said that the IRS had this data coming from W-2s, 1099s, you know, all these reporting forms and requirements that they have set up so that that kind of thing doesn't happen. So, you know, how does that happen?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think presumably you would agree with me. Maybe not. So I will just say it and get your thoughts on it. But I think that the way the U.S. tax system works is fundamentally to impose a more punitive kind of taxation on Americans living outside the United States than inside the United States. And you start looking at PFIX and, you know, all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's in the reporting requirements. I mean, it's really extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly, when you're outside of the U.S., it's much more complicated, and they made it more complicated because they're so afraid of people moving money and hiding assets overseas. So, you know, take our U.S.-based tax cheat who makes $400,000 a year, doesn't bother filing a tax return. That person is not going to get automatic penalties. They're not going to get hit with, you know, 5472 penalties or FBAR penalties or, yeah, PFIC reporting requirements and all this kind of stuff, right? Because if they're based in the U.S., they're just a plain vanilla tax cheat, right?
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the person who's living and working overseas, who's diligently trying to save for their own retirement and accidentally buys a Vanguard UK fund instead of a Vanguard US fund and is now in a PFIC instead of in a mutual fund, yeah, you know, that poor person has to go through all sorts of hoops and hurdles in order to file and, you know, try and make sure that they stay compliant with these rules and regulations. So, yeah.
In your view, I mean, you've seen this for years, and you've also interestingly seen this from the perspective of American citizens living in probably more countries than anybody else, I would guess. Is there any justification at all for these rules?
You know, again, I think the justification is that it's just been on the books for a long time and nobody's willing to remove it because there's not enough voting power for the Americans living overseas. So, nobody really knows what the exact number of Americans living outside the U.S. is. I've seen like a 9 million number kicked around from time to time. I would imagine that maybe 3 million is probably closer to the actual number of, you know, adult citizens living overseas. If you had 3 million people that were able to vote as a block, you know, that would be a pretty big, sizable voting population. You know, if you look at like the population, voting population by state, you know, you'd probably be the 15th largest state or something like that, in that circumstance. But that's not the way it works. So because that's not the way it works, there's very little care or very little view that, you know, these people are, they don't have politicians pandering to them because they don't have the voting power to make it work. If that makes sense.
Yeah. So it's tradition. You know, we've always done this, and it's always been the case that, you know, if you want to live outside our great country, you're gonna have to be punished for that privilege.
And, you know, there's the argument that has been made that, you know, the U.S. will come and bail you out if you need to be bailed out somewhere, or, you know, things like that. Yeah, I was in Indonesia when a couple of the volcanoes were getting a little rowdy back in the day. And there was somebody from the embassy came up to Ubud, Bali, and gave like a little talk. And I remember what they said was, you know, we will come get you, but it might take a week or two for us to get here. So make sure you have food and water to last a week or two. And everybody's like, wait, what? Like, you know, the biggest, most powerful country in the world, it's going to take you 2 weeks to get here to bail us out if the volcano, you know, starts destroying the island. So, yeah, I guess you can take that argument with a grain of salt as well.
Well, David, look at how long it's, you presumably heard this talk about lowering the renunciation fee, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, look at how long this is taking. It'll be up to 2 years by the time it gets done. I mean, you know, it took 10 years to put a man on the moon, 2 years to reduce the fee to renounce U.S. citizenship. These things take time.
There's no motivating factor for the politicians in the U.S. to change any of this stuff.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to lose their seat because expats are angry. That's the thing.
Well, you know, that is, I think, generally true. But, you know, I've been reading lately. So I live in Toronto. I don't know how well you know the geography of Canada, but right across from Detroit, about 4 hours west of me, is a city called Windsor. Okay. And Windsor is, well, in the day at least, like Detroit, was an automotive town, right? So they were really, you know, the same type of thing. Well, I'm reading that Michigan is in trouble for the Democrats. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. You know, related to this Gaza thing. But in the last election, Democrats abroad, you know, really, really went into overdrive trying to get U.S. There's a lot of dual citizens, apparently, who live in Windsor, trying to get them all to vote in the Windsor, sorry, in the Michigan, in the election in Michigan. And I'm wondering if this might not be an opportunity to do equivalent marketing to call out, you know, the whole citizenship taxation thing and say, you know, vote against the Democrats or whatever in Michigan, you know, if you want to make a point on this, because it seems to me this is an opportunity, you know, to credibly make the claim that Americans abroad could play a significant role in an election.
Well, again, I think the issue is that all the American abroad votes, like let's say you got all 3 million people that live overseas to vote, right? First off, most of them are going to be mailing in their ballot. And I think, you know, the last election was the first time anybody even bothered counting the mailed-in ballots. You know, usually it's just the people that show up at the voting, you know, at the polls. They get counted, it gets announced that night, and then over the course of the next couple of weeks, they just double-check that the write-in ballots, you know, there weren't too many of them. An interesting idea, though, would be if you had all these Americans living overseas, if everybody said, all right, we're all going to change our U.S. residency to one specific state, and then they try and take over the state for voting purposes. So, you know, you've got some states with pretty low population numbers. If you got, even if it was just half of those Americans living overseas, you could probably take over the state and be able to control the voting for that state. I don't know how legal or viable or feasible any of that would be.
I don't know, but I mean, states like Wyoming, Montana come to mind.
Yeah. Like Wyoming, I think the population is, what, 500, 600,000 people?
My God, that state is ripe for the taking, I would say.
Or, you know, there's South Dakota.
Imagine, you know, the locals in Wyoming, you know, you say, well, actually, the state's going to be taken over by Americans abroad. It doesn't matter how you vote anymore.
Yeah.
We're going to outvote you. You're going to become irrelevant.
Well, yeah, states like South Dakota, I think they want the RV crowd. And so you don't have to spend a lot of time in South Dakota to become a resident of the state. And if you're in the RV crowd, then you get lower insurance on your car and, yeah, all this stuff because you're a resident of South Dakota. But what would happen if you had a whole bunch of expats get residency there and then, yeah, start forcing some of these, you know, change the voting dynamics based on that? And I guess what would happen is you'd probably have changes at the local level that would make it so that expats couldn't vote in that state anymore. You know, something like that would eventually happen. But
well, I mean, it would illuminate the issue. I mean, this isn't the first time that I've heard a discussion from that perspective. Very interesting. So I understand that there's a saying, the bad thing about good things is they come to an end, and the good thing about bad things is they come to an end. In that spirit and context, I understand that they moved away from Greenback and have a new venture now. So maybe you're talking, first of all, so you're no longer running Greenback. Have I got that right?
Correct. My wife and I are still shareholders in Greenback, but we are no longer the only shareholders. We're no longer the dominant shareholder. And there's a new CEO running Greenback, but I think pretty much the rest of the team stayed the same.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. How do you feel about that? Are you happy to be done with that? I mean,
you know, I think we're very happy with it. It's an amazing process building a business from zero up until, you know, the size it was at. You know, we had thousands of clients all over the world. And now seeing it be able to continue to thrive and grow with new management is fantastic. Yeah, you know, it's a nice feeling.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you definitely played. I mean, you were a name brand for sure. I guess Greenback still is. By the way, where did the name Greenback even come from?
So when we were living in London, we were trying to come up with names for the business. And because we're in London, we went to the pub, and that's where, you know, we were sitting around trying to come up with names. And at the time, I was reading The Economist, you know, the magazine all the time. And they always refer to the US dollar as the greenback. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, you know, that's a pretty good name, right? Yeah, Greenback Tax Service. And, you know, it's the US dollar overseas. Yeah, we're doing taxes for America. And, you know, we looked online, the domain name was available, and we thought, okay, let's do it.
That's great. All right. So you're no longer running a business helping Americans abroad, that is, Americans who left the United States. And my understanding is that you're now running a business to help people trying to get into the United States or run businesses in the United States. So you're kind of shifting directions. Have I got that right?
Yeah, so we've got a business that we've been running for about 7 years now called Clear Tax, CLEER Tax. And that business helps entrepreneurs who are not U.S. citizens, but have a U.S. business entity, stay compliant on their tax work for their U.S. entity. So if you're a UK programmer and you set up a company in Delaware or something like that to sell your software in the U.S., we can help you, you know, file your taxes and do your bookkeeping and make sure that you do all the proper work to make sure you stay compliant, because a lot of those entities will have the same issues that U.S. citizens would have, where they need to file a 5472 or they need to file an FBAR or 5471, you know, all these different kind of forms that most local accountants probably wouldn't know how to do.
So, I mean, it seems to me there's a pattern here, and that is that from a U.S. perspective, anything that is foreign is sort of suspect. Would you say that that's accurate?
I think that's a safe assumption, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So you're still in the tax, and then now I understand that you still have not moved back to the United States. So you're living where now?
We're down in Costa Rica. So we've been expats for almost 22 years now.
You still consider yourself to be an expat?
Yeah, pretty much. It's interesting because I do have a dual citizenship, and, you know, we've been living in different countries around the world for quite a while. But, yeah, I do still consider myself an American.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Costa Rica. So obviously, you know, you, of course, are filing your U.S. taxes and probably paying some U.S. taxes. But with Costa Rica, that's a territorial tax system, is it?
It is, yes.
So have I got this right then, that you're able to live in Costa Rica, you file and pay U.S. taxes, but unless you're earning income in Costa Rica, you'd be not filing or paying taxes in Costa Rica.
Right. So if your job is outside of Costa Rica, let's say you work remotely for a U.S. company, then you wouldn't pay tax in Costa Rica. You would pay tax in the U.S.
All right. Well, that's interesting because you effectively managed to avoid the problems of dual tax residency, which is what the biggest problem, I guess, is, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
So, I mean, if you had, you know, to give some advice to all these Americans abroad, especially since it's tax season, trying to deal with all of this, what would be your message to them after all these years of, you know, being in the tax preparation industry and not really being a tax person, but a survivor? I mean, you could sell t-shirts. I'm a survivor of the U.S. taxes.
You know, I think I had a breakfast meeting with somebody who moved down to Costa Rica from the States today. And my advice to them was get in touch with a tax preparer that knows what they're doing, because there's a lot of tax preparers that don't know how to do the expat side of things. And that's going to be a recipe for success. So if you're an American living outside the U.S., recommend getting in touch with Greenback. And, you know, even if it's just a conversation with somebody there to make sure that they can, you know, take care of your situation, it's well worth doing, because, you know, they are the experts in that space. They know what they're doing. This is the bread and butter. They're just working with expats. It's not like your hometown accountant who is working with the local butcher and the hardware store and, yeah, the teachers and the firefighters. And, oh, you're the one expat that he has as a client. They're not going to stay on top of things the same way as somebody that's working with 200, 300, 500 clients a year who are all expats, who are all going through the same issues each year.
Well, not only that, but presumably you would agree that, you know, if somebody were to come to you and say, well, David, you know, I want to live outside the United States, how will I be taxed by the U.S.? You would agree with the following answer. Well, it depends on where you live.
It does depend on where you live. It depends on how your income is sourced as well. So, you know, there's a lot of different variables there that are going to be important. And again, like, speaking to somebody that knows this stuff is well worth doing.
Oh, I think that's absolutely correct. Absolutely. Well, this has been really great and interesting. As I mentioned, I did meet you, it must have been 6 or 7 years ago in Bangkok.
Yep.
But didn't really chat with you then. So this has been very, very, very interesting, and I thank you for this. And any final messages you'd like to get out, or, you know, coordinates for people who are not Americans but trying to access the U.S. market, which is, I think, what you're doing now, how would people get in touch with you?
Sure. So if you're an entrepreneur living outside the U.S. but with the U.S. entity, you can check out clear.tax. That's CLEER.tax. And if you're an American expat, you can check out greenbacktaxservices.com.
And all right. Well, that's great. And again, I thank you very much for this. Final question, prognosis for change. Do you think that the United States will be getting rid of citizenship taxation anytime soon?
I don't think so, because I don't see it as any sort of pain point for any of the politicians. You know, if nobody's poking them and jabbing them and giving them a hard time about something, I don't see them doing anything.
Unfortunately, I think there's some wisdom and rationality in that statement. All right. Well, this has been great.
I never felt like that, but, you know, that's my view of U.S.
Well, you know, it's not like it's any different from last week or anything. So I don't know that it's a downward note, or that's any different from a couple hundred years ago, other than the fact that, you know, with the introduction of fat guns, there has been it raised the consciousness of this sort of stuff, right?
Yeah, definitely.
And once again, I have had the opportunity today to speak with David McKeon, who is the founder, along with his wife. I'm speaking with David McKeon, who participated with his wife in founding Greenback Tax Services, and he had the wisdom to marry her. Yes.
Thank you very much, John. Appreciate it.
Thank you.